You come and hold forth, please.
Thanks.
I am Fred Wright, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's great to stand up here and see you beautiful people, because not too many 24 hours ago, I wasn't able to stand up and let alone see. So it's a wonderful program for me. It's meant a new life for my Al-Anon Carolyn and myself. And it's just great to be here and see you people, especially all these young people that found this program so early. And that's wonderful. And I want to thank the committee for letting me share this meeting. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do it. And for that, I'm grateful. Thank you. Our preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I've asked Susan to read the 12 steps. Tonight comes to us from Little Rock, Arkansas. I met this fine man yesterday, and I have been listening. And I use the word listening to him. And he has been telling me something. So I'm sure he's going to tell you something before he gets through today. So help me welcome Joe from Little Rock, Arkansas.
My name is Joe, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And through the guide that came into my life as a result of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that hasn't been there serving me to take a drink since March 10th, 1962. This I'm extremely grateful. It is truly good to be here. I've been looking forward to coming to the Georgia Convention. It's my first trip to Georgia. I don't know. I guess you just have to hang around long enough and they'll finally get you this way. It's truly been wonderful. My book says that we'll be going places, doing things that we never expected. And surely, you know, today this is really one of those promises. I was just noticing as I came in of all the beautiful floor arrangements that were behind the stage that I had to kind of laugh. It was so beautiful. I said, you know, I never really thought I'd ever get up, in a big crowd like this with a floor arrangement like this and be able to talk. I know it would be a lot of people back there, but I don't think on that occasion they would ask me to say anything. I never thought I'd get... Usually in those cases, it's another guy up there telling how he was and what happened and how it is now. But I guess, you know, we do everything different. And that's what's so great about this wonderful program. I guess nothing better than to relax me and not you. Because I say, there's nothing better than a little fun in this program. And that's what this program's all about in Waking Life. And usually most of the tales out here is all about a drunk. And none of them are original. But as the guy says, this drunk has had a pretty rough night. And, he was trying to make it in. And his booze was getting to him, so about far as he could get to the beach. And he fell down on the beach, and he made a few steps, and he just lay there in the sand, slept it off. And sometimes in the early morning, the sun began to rise, and he found himself there. And as he awoke, he found there was a lot of confusion down by the ocean, and he wondered what was going on. So he staggered down there, and this happened at some other drunk had gotten into the water, and the Coast Guard was trying to save his life, and it was right in the critical moment. They had just pulled him on the beach, and they were pumping on him, and water was coming out of this one when the second drunk staggered over to see what was going on. And he kept on trying to say to help and interfere, and the Coast Guard, the guys kept on pushing him away, and he wanted to help, he wanted to be a part of it. And they said, get away, we're trying to save this man's life. And the drunk said, hell, if you don't get his behind out of that water, you're going to pump the ocean dry. You know what I mean? Right? They say in Alcoholics Anonymous, we tell a little bit about what we were like and what happened and what it's like today. And I think these are, it's really wonderful. It's a wonderful opportunity every time. You know, I never get really tired of talking about, you know, the wonders of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, what happened in my life. And regardless to where you are today, and I think sometimes many of us don't realize what this program is all about, where you are today, we can all learn more about what happened. You know, and I realize today that I'm standing here with a way of life that I didn't know existed. And today I know a little bit about heaven, and that is a very powerful statement. On the face of this earth, that I know a little bit about heaven through a gift from God unwarranted. And the better I can learn about how this program works and apply these tools to my life, I can grow for the rest of my life. But they say we need to talk a little bit about what it was like, and I won't go on and on today about what it was like, because it's obvious you hear, you know how to get drunk, or you know somebody knows how to get drunk. And I love to talk about the many wonders of my life and how it is now. In my life, miracles are just so commonplace in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And they say miracles are simply getting what you need when you need it. And I get miracles every day in my life. And I'm looking forward to many more miracles in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I think the greatest thing we need to discuss is, you know, really what happened, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in our lives. Jerry was saying last night, I really don't know, as I'm looking back, and I think that's what this program is all about, looking back. You know, I'm a product of my past, my total life. What I am today is a product of everything that's already happened. And through the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm able to look back constantly in my life. And this is a great thing. And I can see myself as I grew up, and I can see I never was really happy anywhere in my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Doing the drinking, and before the drinking, I was always searching. You know, I think sometimes, you know, maybe we do need that little bit extra. And what's wrong with that? Because they say in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we found another dimension of living. And it's in this fellowship that we can learn a little bit about heaven. The things we search for all our lives. And I searched for it as a child. I never did like my childhood. I never did like over the long period of time. It wasn't too good. I had a lot of problems. I grew up in a poor family, and I didn't like being poor. Of course, we didn't know we was poor then. Everybody was poor, you know. And it's really hard to know you're poor when everybody's poor. I know now we was poor then, but then I didn't know. And, you know, we was better off than most people. I had two pair of shoes when most people had, you know, one. I had the Sunday pair and the everyday pair. I don't know, young people, they don't remember that. But I see myself as a child growing up and all the feelings and the problems that went through my life as a child. As I talk about us growing up, my mother would always fix us lunch going to school, and on a good day we had peanut butter. On a good day. I think the whole world was made out of peanut butter in those days. And you know, we were very proud, poor people. That's a different breed of people. We had a lot of pride being poor. And we wouldn't ask for assistance, although we needed it desperately. back in those days, we would take this bread paper sandwich and go to school and wrap it up in the little bread paper and put it in a little sack and go to school. And these other kids that were on relief, that's what the name of it was, relief in those days. All the kids on relief got a free hot lunch, but they had to set at a separate table. Now, us proud poor people, We would make fun of those kids eating free lunches. That seems very strange. But just to show you how the world goes around, now they make fun of me for going to work. You know, it's really kind of goes around. When I grew up amongst these people, I never did like what went on in my life. Finally, you know, I was about 19 years old when I was introduced to alcohol. And, you know, I think to most people it comes gradually, but to me it comes suddenly. I remember my first drink very vividly. And I remember what happened as looking back over it now. Through what I found, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. For the first time in my life, I found some relief, some magic in my life. I found a level of comfort that I had not experienced before. Every time I picked up a drink during my drinking, I picked that drink up to seek this relief. You know, the big book, the doctor's opinion speaks of it so beautifully. You know, I never could see what alcohol was taking out of my life. I could not differentiate the true from the false. I could always look at what it was giving me. And I pursued this thing down to the gates of insanity or death. Now, I really feel very blessed, and those of us, that we do see. You know, because my book says that great illusion that we perceive. An illusion is something that appears in one way, but is another way. And we pursue it to the gates of insanity and death. And I think that we're very blessed to be able to see, because many others have this opportunity to see and do not see. Many others hear the same thing and do not hear. So I had a lot of problems as a result of alcohol, and I won't give you the blow-by-blow description of it. It says I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like. And drunks are just like anything else, you know. They're horrible, and it's like it's kind of hard to hear about, but you see one, you've seen them all. I decided to get married. I was going to college that time, and I decided to leave school and get married, which I did. And it wasn't one of them shotgun types. It was just a bad decision. And that was the beginning of a lot of bad decisions I was going to make. And with a young drinking problem, blooming drinking problem, and a young marriage with all its problems anyway. We lasted about 5 years. And two kids born in this marriage, and it wasn't nothing but trouble. You know, we fought. All constantly. Like the guy said, the second time I decided to get married, I started off somebody at least I was a friend with, you know. But anyway, I ended up 27 years old, like all drunks, back at my father's house. 27 years old and been out and made it around, broke. In all areas of my life, and back with my father. My home is in Louisville, Kentucky. My father lived to be 86 years old. He seen me find a good life in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and surely we had a wonderful relationship for many years. But back in those days, he was up in age, and I don't know, I'm like a lot of drunks, and whenever I got in trouble, I'd always return to my father's house. You know, I always got interested in my family when I got broke. I'd say, that's not right doing your father that way. And I'd go home, and he wasn't like the prodigal son's father. He didn't have his hand stretched out. He just kind of put his hand back where his pocketbook and held on to it and saw me coming. That old man never would let me have no money or anything. And I used to, back in those days, going, I'd been by college. I was a smart man, slick anyway, which is not intelligent. But he was so far ahead of me, it was pitiful. It was the only way he would lend me any money was to leave town. You know, I'd stay around there and lose a job and get in trouble and embarrass him. And then I'd say, well, this town ain't doing me no good. I think I'm going up to Cincinnati. He said, how much you want to borrow some money? He would always lend me some money. It was 2 or 3 years. I was 2 or 3 years sober before I figured out what he was doing to me. So I left and went off several times in these couple of years occasions, and I was off, and things kind of fell apart for me. I often wonder at times, you know, I think that this time in my life that God came into my life. Not because he liked me, but because he loved me. Because God was concerned about my situation. And I love that he talks about he left the 99 and came after the one. And I thank God come into my life, not through my invitation, but through maybe just because he loved me. And at this particular time, what was going on with me, I thought about a sister that I had in Little Rock, Arkansas. And she had went to college there and stayed and got married and was trying to struggle and beginning to finish her education. And I hadn't seen her for 6 or 7 years, and I said, now that's not right, treating her that way. You need to go see your sister. And this is the way I came to Little Rock. You know, I'm a very blessed person today. I hope that each and everybody in this room, in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, could receive the blessings that God has put into my life. You know, and this is why I talk about that other dimension of living. It talks about what this program has to offer. No, it says, there are many mansions in God's house. You know, and I realize, you know, that today I feel like I stand in one of God's ultimate mansions. You know, not only has God given me a new life, he has given me a purpose for my life. And I think, you know, that each and every person on this earth is created for a purpose. And I think the happiest we can ever be in our lives is to pursue through God's directions and find the purpose of our creation. In the last few years of my life, I began to realize, you know, that I'm where I'm supposed to be doing, where I'm supposed to be at, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm doing God's work. And, you know, but I didn't think I was coming to Little Rock, Arkansas to do God's work 20-some years ago, because I was broke and I didn't want to come and I was just running away from things. And I came to Little Rock, and I traveled just like most drunks. Drunks still travel the same way today. I got to town early, 4 o'clock, one suitcases with neckties, little paper sacks, and freezer cardboard boxes. And this is the way I came to Little Rock. And I went to my sister's house, and she was just finishing school. She had dropped out of school a couple of times to help a couple of kids. She is one of them kind of people that just bug the hell out of me. One of them normal, you know, I always say, ain't nothing wrong with me. They got a disease called normal, really. Yeah. And that disease, that's a bad disease. They say the end result of alcoholism is insanity and early death. And the end result of being normal is a late death and early insanity. So, you know. So They were just bugged. You know, these people, you know, they were involved in church and all that bit. And my sister, she's been involved in playing the organ in our little church. And she's been involved in music since she was just a kid. And I can remember when she was a kid at home, sitting there, her feet wouldn't dangling off the piano stool. Now she went later on, she's about 12, she started taking voice, and she has a beautiful voice. So she was the organist in our little church, and her husband at the time happened to be the lay minister. Today he's a pastor of one of the larger United Methodist churches there at home. But at this time, they were involved in this little church, and these people would get up every Sunday morning doing their bit, and I'd be trying to sleep in from the night before, and it kind of embarrassed me. And they would finally start talking about inviting me to church, and after about 2 or 3 weeks, they sounded like they were threatening me, so I decided to go with them. And this is where God placed the first person in my life, my Al-Anon, Lou Bell. Lou Bell is she's a part of my life. You know what I mean? Not my sobriety and the struggle and my total life today. We're a part of each other's life. But I remember the morning we met in church, and God works through people. Of course, she talks about it in a different way, but I can see, you know, after all, this nice-looking young man at that time, coming into church, and I was disguised by the organist and the lay preacher, so that's a pretty good front, you know. And you know how we alcoholics operate. We make our living by selling fast conversation to these slow-thinking Al-Anons. So I give them my best shot, you know. And in about 3 months, we got married. I didn't let her do no thinking. And I remember, you know, she had a little home there. She had an automobile. She had a job. God, man, you know. And I convinced her how bad she needed me to help her. And we were married. I always was a great guy for celebrating. I think most of the alcohol occasions mean something to an alcoholic, you know. So, you know, that's the time to drink, you know. And I stocked in the good supply of liquor, and it was at Christmas time anyway. And so I didn't took off from work, and of course she went to work. I was a go getter. I took her to work and went and got her. And I sat there and drank. And you know, after about 3 days, I remember the hurt, and I remember the shock in her eyes. I can see it now, because after 3 days, boy. She still figured out what she had. That's why Al-Anon is such a great in our lives. You know, it heals these wounds, and it's a great part of my life. Al-Anon is a great part of my life. And after 1 week of drinking there, I made my first trip to the old nut house. Now, we didn't have detox centers in those days. We know we just had the old drying out place, the old Arkansas Insane Asylum is where I was, still in stone up there on the wall. And this is where I went. And I know, you know, this is why I say I know how embarrassed my wife was. I know how she felt after, you know, being married 1 week. After 1 week of marriage, she went to church that Sunday and somebody said, "How's marriage life?" She said, "That fool's in the nut house already." She did me in 1 week. I tell her all the time, she's going to run me crazy. She said, "You still an outpatient. They ain't never cut you loose." Didn't do me no good. I was the smartest guy in that nut house. I remember going around helping all them crazy. I was going around helping them, you know, talking to them and counseling them. You know, our book talks about, our steps talk about restoring me to sanity. You know, many, many times we say it's talking about, you know, where I did some crazy thing when I drank. But it's, you know, that's, you're supposed to quit drinking before you take the first step. And the second step is still talking about restoring me to sanity. It has nothing to do with drinking. It's talking about the state of the mind preceding the first drink. You have to be insane. And I was. I can see the insanity of my mind. You know, I continued to drink, and back and forth, I was a traveling drunk. You know, I'd do this and go, I'm come and go. It wasn't no marriage. I couldn't get this traveling. I'd drink and take a drink and go off somewhere and be gone 2 or 3 months, a couple of months. Then finally I'd say, "That's not right, doing your wife that way. You need to go home." And she didn't know when I was coming or going either way. And it was on one of these occasions that I met the next person God placed in my life. And over, you know, I always say God uses the strangest people. He uses people that, you know, you don't use the learned sometimes. And it's not the high, it's very small people. And this little while I was in a bar in Kansas City, and I was up there, and I was on one of these excursions, and I had gotten in bad shape down there. And, you know, one morning I needed a drink. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I needed a drink, and I went down to this bar. And it wasn't any social drinkers in there. It wasn't nothing in there but winos. And I really didn't associate with winos unless my money said wine. I was not a wino. And I lowered myself to go down there and talk with these guys, and they were trying to get their money together. I think it was 60 cents to get a pint of wine. And big shot as I was, I said, "That's okay, I'll buy." And, you know, and this girl, I remember met her name. Her name was Lucille. I don't remember any other bar. The millions I saw. It wasn't there but a few times. I don't know how I remember her. But she would always, they wouldn't give the winos the bottles. You know, they would sell it in bottles and pour it in glasses. And you'd have to order, like, "Give me a pint on 3 or a pint on 4. That's where we ordered. And we said a pint on 3, I believe, that morning. She put 3 big glasses up there and she poured it in the in the glasses, and then she would flip this bottle in a huge barrel. Well, you know, Lucille could start at one glass and go to second and go to third. And when she finished, she just went to the barrel, and these glasses would be level. She had an art of pouring this wine. And, you know, all the winos used to talk about, you know, how great she was at doing this. And, you know, nothing is perfect for them. After she finished, they all got down and looked at it, you know. I didn't know. And you know, they classy people. Finally determined that one glass did have a hair more than the other. No, nothing is perfect for them kind of people. And they reached over and got that one and gave it to the guy who bought. That made me feel good, helping these poor winos. And as we began to talk, a little guy named Van, and little Van looked at me and he said, Joe said, you know, you're a pretty nice guy. Well, I'd been knowing that. And he said, you're a lot different from me and you're a lot different from a lot of these guys down here on the street. I knew that too. But then he looked up at me with little tears rolling down his cheek as he took his first drink that morning and shook. And I can see his eyes now. And he said, Joe, you're drinking too much. Well, I'd heard it from the psychiatrist. I heard it from a lot of people. But Van had something that those other people didn't have, I guess. Or maybe I was ready to hear. Because I think that was where it stuck. And I remember, you know, that place. And I remember this thing began. I got to go home. I got to get out of here. I got to do something about this. So after about 4 or 5 days, I just tore out of Kansas City. Just caught a bus because I would get drunk every day. And one day I just took what I had, caught a bus, and left there. Left whatever I had in this little apartment I had and just went straight to the bus station. I caught a bus and I came back. And I came back and I decided that I did have a problem with my alcohol. I didn't know the exact nature of my problem, but I knew it was drinking. So I said, why don't you quit? So I decided to quit. And I think that was the worst thing ever happened to me in my life, when I quit drinking. You know, I think about all the problems I had. I think about the hospitals. I think about the jails. I think about being broke. I think about picking up out a cigarette butt out of the gutter. I've been there. All those things happened in my life. But I think the worst time was when I wasn't drinking. And I didn't take a drink for 9 months, and I went through all these things, and finally one morning, you know, that day came. And, you know, I think that's what this prophecy, it talks about associating in our lives the experience of these first 100 people. This is their lives. The experience of the first 100. And what I was able to do when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was to associate the experiences of these people with the experiences in my life. And when I opened this book, I was glad to hear about that day will come without some defense against this first drink, because I thought I was unique. And that morning I took that drink, and I went through this well-known spree, and after about 2 months I ended up at the doors of this old hospital right where I left 2 years ago. Sick, broken, ready. I was sitting on a bar that morning, just like all other mornings of this drunk. And I was drinking, and I had about $2 left in my pocket, and it seemed like I just gave up. I just gave up. You know, I see so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, are always talking about we got to find God. God ain't lost. You know, this program, if he was a drunk, couldn't find it no way, if he was. See, this program's all about giving up on you. And that morning I gave up on me, and the very next thing that came into my mind, well, why don't you go back to that hospital? And I swore I would never go back there. And if you had been there, you would have swore the same thing. So I called a cab with my last $2 and paid cab fare to the nut house. You know, that's a miracle. And I thought they wasn't going to let me in. I was worried. They let me in. And I don't know if any of y'all have. I think we should have some of these kind of institutions left. I see some people that still need that kind of treatment. It worked good for me. You know, all these fancy drying out places, and I'm nice. I think that we need some of them, but I'm sure glad they didn't start none of them when I was around. They'd kill me. They'd detox me to death. I'd still been laying up there. You know what I mean? A But these people, they didn't have nothing like that in those days. They just throwed us about 80 people on that ward, and I mean, they were some sick people. Those guys on that ward, one guy there was 36 years old. He'd been there since he was 6 years old. It was people there that their families had brought there and just left them. These were the back wards of the mental hospital. And those people, I've seen people that hunger for love. And I've seen how this is a different society of people. It's a different thing altogether. And I noticed when I went in there, wouldn't nobody have anything to talk to say to me. They stood back and watched me. And I finally found out what was happening. See, all the mental people would watch us alcoholics. And we alcoholics would have company. And some of those guys been there for 20 and 30 years and never had a visitor. Never had anybody take... I've seen individuals with no interest in their lives. No one concerned by them as human beings. And I seen them totally shut off. And I seen those people, they would watch us. And we would get visitors. The aides would even talk to us. They wouldn't talk to them. And so they wanted to be, it was about four or five of us alcoholics. And about 75 of the nuts. And the nuts would see us getting all this treatment. And when you ask one of them what he was in there for, he said, oh, I'm an alcoholic. See, he wanted to be in the upper class. That's the only place I've ever been where alcoholism was a status symbol, but it was a status. And quite naturally, all us alcoholics, when you asked us what we were in there for, we said nervous breakdown. So, you know, you couldn't. Yeah. So they stood around and watched me. Finally, this little guy came up, and his name was Ora. And I thank God for Ora's life today, for his life in my life. And Ora had the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he sat down beside me that Monday, and he had the big book. And I love the work of Paul. It says, God's grace is sufficient. That's all. That's saying a lot. God's grace is good enough. He don't give out no bonuses or nothing. And Ora had the big book and the carton of Camel cigarettes. That's all he needed. Now, I was broke. I didn't have no money. A cigarette. Didn't nobody on that place have any a dime. A ready roll cigarette was something you didn't see. And this guy's got a whole carton. Now, I didn't have no trouble with talking about your life is unmanageable. Because the only way out, they give me some of that roll, that top tobacco. I never did learn how to roll that tobacco. I want a cigarette so bad, I'd try to roll it in there, I'd be shaking it, burn all up and fall down in my lap. The only way I could smoke was take my tobacco and paper, give one of them nuts and let him roll it and lick it and give it back to me. You know, that's the only way I could smoke. And here this guy got a whole carton. And so he sits down and starts talking about this thing, because he didn't know anybody. To me. And I think, you know, that's the way it is in the program. We want the person with 25 years sobriety. You know, the person with 30 years, how much sobriety you got to be our sponsor, to direct us. You know, we got to have the learned to show us how to get this program. I didn't have that. Only thing I had, a guy with a carton of cigarettes, a big book, and 10 days of locked up sobriety. But he had more than I had, and what he got me was really what you can get any drunk with love. He showed some concern for me. This was a sweet little guy, and he was so nice to me for about two or three days, you know, that Wednesday night. He'd give me cigarettes all week. I didn't want what he had. I wasn't interested. I didn't know nothing about it. That Wednesday night, the OA dropped his paper about 7:30, and they didn't stop for nothing, fights or nothing else. They didn't get up out of their chairs for nothing. It was 80 people and two aides. That Wednesday night, the OA dropped his paper, and he said, all you winos, AA meeting. I left the back wards of an old mental hospital over 20 years ago to go out into a dining room, old dining room, wherever we used to eat. Because Ora had given me some cigarettes. And he told me that these three guys from Alcoholics Anonymous would bring three packs of cigarettes and lay on the table. and he told me that they would bring some hot coffee. And I went out there to get a cigarette and a cup of coffee. And God gave me a brand new life. God gave me a way of living that I never knew existed. And tonight, today, I know a little bit about heaven. And I really didn't deserve it. You know, I remember them three guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them became my sponsor. You know, I was always, when I went out there, I said, these I knew what AA was, a bunch of do-gooders, always. I was hard on do-gooders. And I had them summed up as something like a plainclothes Salvation Army. You know, something, the same thing, except they didn't have uniform. And I knew they was going to come out there meddling in your business. It's like all them, you need to do this, you need to do that. You know, that's what them do-gooders do. They're full of what you need to do, you know. And I was going to tell him off. I had my defenses up. And this idiot got up and started talking about himself. He didn't tell me nothing to do. He talked for a whole hour about himself. And then that bugged me. You know what I mean? He didn't. I should have left him alone. I really should have. He was over there drinking coffee, and I slid over there. Since he didn't make me mad, I went picking on him. And he's a big guy, and I walked up beside him, and I said, "Hey, man, I hear what you say about all what you did." I said, "But what do you think I should do?" And he looked down at me and said, "Hey, baby, I don't really give a damn what you do. That's your business, you know." You know, I think that's what really turned me on about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I left the hospital and I was out for a while, and then I came, Ora wrote me a letter. Ora, after about 6 weeks out of the hospital, Ora wrote me a letter. And he said, "I'm coming back to Little Rock to the meeting. I don't have time to write you. I will see you there." And he lived 90 miles away, and I'd been out of the hospital for 6 weeks, and I hadn't been to a meeting. Now, I don't know where I'd be tonight if it wasn't for the life of a guy and a little letter that he wrote me that brought me back to AA that night, because I hadn't drank. You know, and I met Ora that night, and some things began to happen in my life. Later on, sometimes I don't talk about it, maybe because... And sometimes I feel like talking about it, sometimes I don't. But you know, Ora never found this way of life. And he was a sweet little guy. After 3 years of sobriety, they called me to the detox. We had a new detox center, and I was sober. I went to the detox center to see Ora. Try to be an instrument in the life of this little man. And from year in, year out, after 10 years, about every other year, I would contact him or see him. I saw him steady. I seen alcoholism steady. Take away his life. After many, many years, I became involved in opening up the Serenity House. And the first year, Ora was brought to me. And I went out that morning to look in the back of the car, and that was this wreck of this sweet little old guy that had been an instrument in my life. And I attempted to work with him, and it didn't take. And about a month later, he was killed in an automobile. He never found what he so freely gave to me. I don't know too much about God. But it was there that night that things began to happen in my life. My book, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about the solution to alcoholism. It says we are average Americans. And I went there that night to that meeting, and I remember that first meeting, and I think I came under the umbrella of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says there that this is part of the program. This is the first thing you can do with a drunk. And it began right there that night. And I went home that night, and my wife, Louvelle, asked me, she wanted to know all about this AA thing. She said, "What is that thing? What do they do?" I said, "They don't do much, just smoke a lot of cigarettes, drink a lot of coffee, but it sure makes you feel good. I believe I'll go back." And I think that this is the beginning, and this is what was there, that is what is here, not what we say or do from the podium, but it's that thing that's here. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, "We are average Americans, come from all sections of the country." It talks about different social, religious, political, and economic backgrounds. And right in this room, you know, people from all parts of the country, different political backgrounds, different social backgrounds, different economic backgrounds, we can say even different races. We are normally people who should not mix. We are a strange conglomeration of people in this room. None of us should have never known the other. We have nothing in common. Our paths should have never crossed. I wonder sometimes at these conferences, and I look over throngs of people, if we would take out the subject, Alcoholics Anonymous, we couldn't carry on a conversation. But as among us as strange kind, there is something indescribably wonderful. It talks about the friendliness and the fellowship and understanding between us as strange kinds of people. Then he gives us a beautiful illustration of what this is all about. He said, we are like the passengers on the great liner. And I can see these people on the liner. Now, they had a real class system. They were classed on this liner by political, by economics, you know what I mean? And by religion. There were all sort of a class system on these liners. And the more money you had, the higher you went. And in the lower part of the vessel, on the bottom, was the steerage section. You know, this is where the peons traveled. Yeah. And as you came up, it got higher and higher and higher. And when you got in the uppermost dining room, the string music was playing and all the beauty. And if you really had prestige, you could sit at the table with the captain. So the guy at that captain's table had nothing to do, nothing in common with that guy in the steerage section. Their paths should have never crossed. They had nothing in common until they hit that iceberg and both of their behinds hit that water. Then they had something in common. They had a common problem. And this is what binds us. This is what binds us. But then my book goes on to say this would have not held us as we're now held. And a lot of times, you know, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is fine. And I hear a lot of people say, go to meetings in 90 days and you'll be all right. Now, that's fellowship. That ain't what my book says. Hear me? My books don't say that. And I think sometimes, you know, we give these people a chance. Give them the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They say the other thing that we join in Brothers and Harmonies is actually we have a common solution. Then on page 25 of my book, it says the common solution to alcoholism is a vital spiritual experience. But a fellowship is fine. But we got to change. And so I started going around I remember just the club, and I would go to the old dormitory. This is where, and remember, I talk about it all the time, and I think you can look at me and tell, even though my name is McQueenie, I don't get too many invitations to the St. Patrick's Day parade. And this was in 1962 when we were having sit-ins and demonstrations. And about six blocks from where I was going to AA, there were sit-ins and demonstrations going on at that time. You know, I always did everything at the wrong time. This wasn't really the time for me to show up. And I was the first black in Little Rock area in Alcoholics Anonymous 20 years ago. And I had a lot of problems. But it didn't bother me. You know, I had a ticket. We were talking about that earlier before the meeting. That's what this prayer I had. I had an admission. An admission means to let one in. And you know how we get that? Through our sufferings. We can get a ticket. And I had paid the price. I had a ticket. I think this is what the jewels of this, our fellows, at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, our sufferings are turned into the most precious thing, a desire to stop drinking. So I had a ticket. I didn't care what they did. You know, and I would go to the meeting, club meeting some mornings, and they would, I know one morning O'Neill put his arms around me, and he said, son, I need to talk to you. He don't know how much that meant to me to say son to me. But I guess, I don't know, maybe he did it to everybody, but to me, he would always say son, and he would put his arms around my shoulder. And talk about the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this old man who told me one morning, he said, Joe, he said, you're welcome to come to the meeting. He said, I want you to see you specifically in the morning here. He said, but I got to talk to you. He said, I have a lot of problems when you come. He said, but what I want you to do is come to the meetings and don't stand around and drink coffee. Just come to the meetings and ask the meetings to leave. He said, but be back in the morning. And I was back. I was back. Because I had a ticket. That desire to stop drinking.
Finally, you know, I began to
know that this fellowship was not enough. Like I said, you can't sit in a chicken house and become a chicken. It's fine. You know, I sucked up this fellowship. And finally, I began to know that, you know, I had to make some changes in my life. And I think the big book, this program's all about changing and change, not just changing in once, but it's talking about changing for the rest of our lives. Let's talk about what Paul talks about. We could change and change and change into where nobody would even know us. And we could change our lives constantly. It's daily dying to be something better. And I had to die. You know, I had to change. I had to become something else. You know, it's quite obvious you can't stay what you are and expect anything different. Like we say, what we believe and what we think we are. So as a man thinketh, that shall he is. We're a product, whatever we think, that's what we're going to be. I didn't know Flip Wilson was talking about that many years ago. They say, what you see is what you get. So I had to change, and I have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a program of change. And, you know, and I think that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, are very simple. To me today, they're very simple. And I think the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in this plan does three things, basically, for the alcoholic. It's no different than any other kind of problem solving. If you got a problem that was said this morning, the first step in problem solving is to find out the exact nature of the problem. Simple problem solving. And then once you find the exact nature of the problem, then you can find a solution. And based on those two conclusions, then you can lay out a plan of recovery. So to me, the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous simply is a problem statement. It states what the problem is. And then after you see where you are and you see what the problem is, the second step says, we believe you ought to be over here. It establishes another point. And once we establish these two points, then we have 10 simple steps to go from 1 to 2. You know, alcoholism as a disease is like all other diseases. And they used to say, when you go to a doctor with a problem, the first thing he does is he does a diagnosis to find out what is the problem. Then after he finds out what's the problem, then he writes you a prescription. And then you gotta go home and take the prescription. Same system. Except alcoholism is a unique illness in which the victim has to diagnose, prescribe, and carry out his treatment plan. And this is why he needs help. It showed me the exact nature of my problem. And I had an idea alcohol was involved, but I didn't know the exact nature. You know. And when I go to a doctor, the doctor says, you know, I believe you need an operation. I said, well, what do you think's wrong, doc? He said, I don't know, but we're going to operate it Wednesday. I said, the hell we are. Not until you find out a little more than that. But I know today, you know, thank God for Dr. Silkworth. And remember, we talk about the big book of alcohol. We talk about Bill. But remember, it was Dr. Silkworth who told Bill the exact nature of his problem on his trip to the town. He gave it to Bill. He gave it to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in very front of our textbook, you know. And I think that's why doctor's opinion is so important, because the program of recovery is based on recovering from the condition that he describes in the front. That's reading it's bad to start off in chapter 5. You missed the front part. And, you know, it talks about, he tells me, and I have a dual problem that is going to involve my spiritual life. Man is physical, mental, and spiritual. It's a total health problem. But now my part of my problem is an allergy to alcohol. I have a physical allergy to alcohol. When I take alcohol, I crave the second drink. When I take a drink, I crave another drink. And he said, this is abnormal and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. I didn't realize that other people didn't crave alcohol. I thought normal people use willpower. Hell, they don't use willpower. They don't crave it. You know what I mean? When I take a drink, I crave a second drink. And he said, you know, this never occurs in the average temperate drinker. And that's why them people do that. I watch them on the airplane, and they'll get a drink and shake it and fool around and stir it and go reading their magazines. One of them said, here a few months ago, said, I need some peanuts. I'm like, what the hell? You know. Oh. Once I take a drink, I have a phenomenal craving. And this is physical. And I crave the second drink and the third drink. And if you have an allergy to alcohol, it's the simplest, like all other allergies, the same treatment. All major allergies. You know, doctors doesn't treat your allergy. He really finds out what you're allergic to, and he does the same thing. He said, if you're allergic to alcohol, don't take the first drink, and you will never crave the second one. That's simple. You don't have to be no genius to do that. So that's half of my problem is I have a physical allergy to alcohol. Now, the other half of my problem is mental. I have an obsession to drink. He talks about I become restless, miserable, and discontent, and I become a lot of other things when I don't drink. And he said, once I get to a point, I remember the sense of ease and comfort that came the last time. When it gets painful, I remember the comfort of the last drink. And this obsession, this idea that overcomes all other ideas, makes me reach over and take that drink. And then my mind sets off the craving in my body, and I go through the well-known spree. I think it's a great diagnosis of my problem. For the first time in my life, I've seen the exact nature of my problem. Because if you can't drink because of the physical allergy and can't quit because of mental obsession, then you are powerless over alcohol. And I found the exact nature of my problem. Not almost, but the exact nature of my problem. So once I seen that where I was, the second step said, we believe you need to be over here. And that's the first step, you know, in any kind of anything we achieve in our lives, we have to believe. Believing is the sum total of all our accomplishments. And, you know, our book talks about it throughout this, it talks about Columbus. We were talking about today. You know, in Columbus's day, he must have been, you know, they say he had a problem like us. You know, he really must have been one, because, man, it's hard to believe the world is round when everybody else believes it's square. You know. But Columbus hung in there, you know. He was hard-headed, you know. And he believed. And he talks about the Wright brothers, you know, hadn't Professor Langley's machine, hadn't greater men failed at flying? Our book talks about these great principles of living. My life today, and this program gave me so many of them, it taught me how to believe. You know, my life is not limited but by one thing. My life, the limitation of my life is what I believe. If I want to change my future, I've got to change what I believe today. And I can grow forever if I can change what I believe. So it says, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And it was easy for me to look at the other people and do this. I could look at the God, believe that God could restore me to sanity. No, it didn't say, it didn't say I was crazy. The word sanity means whole. It comes from the word sanitas, which it didn't say I wasn't. Was all gone. It just says I wasn't all there, you know. And insanity is to say when we believe a lie. To believe a lie is insanity. And you know, I believe lies. And they say when you believe lies, the truth will set you free. And they say hell is the truth seen too late. And I believe lies. See, I would go out and take a drink. And it would damn near kill me. I'd almost get put out at home, and I'd have all kind of problems, and my life would be balled up, and I would get out of all that situation. In about 6 weeks, I'd be walking down the street. Sober. Restore me to sanity, sober. And while I was going down the street, I'd believe a lie. And I'd walk in the liquor store and say, mister, give me another half pint of that. This time it ain't going to hurt me. And I would believe that lie, and it damn near killed me. Now, I really can't do that today. Because the truth has set me free. So the second step talks about a solution. Once we see where we are, then we can find a solution. And I think this step is old as mankind himself. It's the same program the prodigal son used many years ago. This is not a new program. Ain't nothing new about it except the words. The principles are the same. The prodigal son had a problem. You know, he was sort of, I think he was one of us too. He had went off into a foreign land, and he said wine, women, and song. I had a woman kind of come up and speak to me about that one day. Said, Joe, didn't say a whole lot of women about women. I said, but you know a young man ain't going to waste his money on apple pie, hot dogs, ice cream, and Chevrolets. There had to be some women in there. But here this guy, see, he had got off. He said, give me mine. And there's three things talked about. Let's talk about the other items. We talk about the prodigal son, but there was a coin that was lost. And there was some sheep that were lost. There was a sheep that was lost.
And we went. So the shepherd had to go out and find the sheep. In that relationship, the shepherd is the director. So it was the shepherd's job to go out and find the sheep. And the woman that lost the coin, she owned and controlled the coin, so it was her job to retrieve it and find it. She swept diligently until she found it. Then she called in her neighbors, and they rejoiced. But the prodigal son and I were different from the coin and the sheep. We had the ability of self-will. We were lost, but remember, he left on his own. He said, give me mine. I don't want to wait around for no funeral. I'm going to go out. He went around and wasted with riotous living and ended up in the pig pen of all places. Now, that's a bad place for a little Jew boy to be. It's a pig pen. They don't like pigs, you know. And there he was in the pig pen, and I imagine he was just like me. He was talking about one of these days my ship going to come in, you know. People, you know, he fantasized, and he, if they leave me alone, everything be all that. But one morning, he took the first step. You know, the woman found the coin. The shepherd found the sheep. The prodigal son said, and he found himself. He had to find himself since he got lost on self. And I think we're very blessed that we were able to do this, because not many alcoholics would ever have this opportunity. You know, but after he found himself, he said, look, man, I'm in a pig pen. It scared him. Then he said, you know, I believe they're eating better at my father's house. He came to believe after he saw where he was. Same program. After we take the first two steps, the second, third step, and the final program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that the main purpose of these steps, the main purpose of the book, the main purpose of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a plan of recovery based on the first two steps. We have 10 simple steps which are guaranteed to bring about this vital spiritual experience. Because it says the solution to alcoholism is a vital spiritual experience. And once we establish this, then we're able to begin. Based on the first two steps, third step says make a decision. The first step in recovery is to make a decision. A decision means to dissect. It means to cut two facts in two. And it says we stood at the turning point. And I had two alternatives, one of power, one of powerless. And I stood at the turning point. And my book talks about, you know, that we have these the end results, insanity or death, or life on a spiritual basis. These are not the easiest alternatives. But I had to make a decision. And he said, this was the beginning, and the first thing, you know, that we have to do, this decision, like we say, is not to find God. It's all about removing self. The third step is not to find God. It's to get self out of the way. God will come in where we go out. That's the only way to find God, is to get out. That's the law of nature. The basic laws of nature. Anytime you move something, something else will move in. It's all about getting ourselves out of the way. And so I had to make this decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God. And this removed self. And this was the first step to recovery. My book said all good ideas are simple. But this one simple idea was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which we passed to freedom. This simple step here, it removed the root of my problem, self-will. You know, I really don't know how, you know, alcoholics, you know, my biggest problem ain't alcohol. My biggest problem is self-will, right? All my life has been self-will. You know. And that means, you know, I don't see how people got the idea that alcoholic could be weak. Our book is talking about our problem is strength. You know what I mean? Alcoholic, you know, if you were weak, you couldn't become an alcoholic. You got to be strong to be an alcoholic. You got to hang in there and suffer, you know. One of them weak people, the first time he vomited, he quit, man, you know. See, weak person take a drink and get sick, and he said, I better leave that stuff alone. Alcoholic take a drink and get sick, he said, it must be some way I can do it without getting sick. You know, that's so once we take step three, and then we go to work, in 4, 5, 6, and 7, the spiritual, the center is laid in, the core, and then we go to work on our minds. You know, 4, 5, 6, and 7 talk about ourselves. I am a product of my mind. So is a man thinking, Jeff. So 4, 5, 6, and 7 is go and work on our mind. And the results of 1 and 2, 3 we put in the spiritual foundation. Then we go to work on our minds. And it says we gotta go to work. You know, and if you pray for potatoes, next thing you gotta do is get a hoe. That's right. In case some of you guys in the city, not one of those with high heel shoes either. You know what I mean? But you gotta go to work. And you know, then it talks about to identify the things within me, take an inventory. So it says a fact-faced searching and searching and fearless. You know, fact-facing, fact-finding. Inventory, list of items in trade. What are we trading for life? I had to look and see the things that I was trading for life. The things, what I traded is what I got. And I was able oneself to remove the stakes, take the stock of the things that I had in trade to my fellow man and to the world. And I sure seen what was wrong with my life. But man, I didn't have nothing in stock. I was trading garbage. And that's what I was getting, garbage. And I made a list of these things. And then step 5, it talks about to bring these things up out of the inside. With these 3 beautiful little steps by relating them to God, then ourselves, and then another human being. And then once we get these things to the surface, we make these adjustments in 6 and 7, and we have worked on ourselves. Then we have another area of concern, because once you work on your relationship with God and then on yourself, then we have 2 sets to deal with our relationship with other people. We go into the social aspect of our life, which was produced by my thinking. And I know that my spiritual sickness produced my mental sickness, and my mental sickness produced the sickness I had with other people. And I like what Chuck says, alcoholism is the inside job. This is why we start within and work without. And in this last area of work, I cleared up my relationship with other people. And then my book talks about the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is why I don't like to talk about these things without the context of the book, because we get them all out of scope. The promises come after the 9th step. After we clean up our relationship with God, our relationship with ourselves, and relationship with other people, then it says we'll know this new freedom. And this is where we should begin to know. We started out believing. See, believing is the beginning, but once you believe, then you make a decision. That's step 3. You believe at 2, make decide at 3. Then the next thing in the endeavor, after you decide, then you got to act as you decide. And we got these 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, which is action. So we believe, we decide as we believe, and we act as we decide. And once we get through acting, then we know, because we get results. Once we get results, we no longer believe, we know. In our 12th step, that those who know, you know, we carry this message to others and help them come to believe. So now I have a program after this area to work for the rest of my life. And I think that this is where it says, you know, half of our progress, it talks about the other half. Where is the other half? The other half must lie within these last 3 steps. The other half of our development, which we pursue for the rest of our lives, the quality of our lives. Step 10 says, watch the self creeping back in. And it's talking about the first part, 1, 2, and 3. And it says, watch for resentments and fear, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And it says, when we're wrong, promptly admit it, 8 and 9. So through the step 10, each day I practice and work in each area of my life. You know, this program's all about growing through elimination. And I see now a lot of people talk about you got to get this, you got to get that. And my program, my book don't say a thing about getting anything. It's all about getting rid of things. It talks about relieve me of the binds of self. Take away my difficulty. Remove the things for me that are objectionable. It's all about getting to perfection through elimination. And as I can eliminate and grow for the rest of my life by practicing the last 3 steps. And I see so many people come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and turn this program into just a not drinking program. This is a program of living. And we have the opportunity through these steps in this program to live better than most people on the face of this earth. And we're just wasting it, some of us, as I did times in my life, just not to drink. And step 11 talks about through prayer and meditation. Through step 11, and step 3, we turn over to God. And step 11, now that we've cleaned the things out that block us off from God, I'm able to practice this meditation to receive God's direction. To turn over my directions and now to receive God's directions. And my book tells me exactly how to apply these things to my life. And then we come to the final step 12, which is a great part of my life. And I think a great growth step. These steps are for me. And, you know, in many years of years past, I have been, this has become a big part of my life, carrying this message to other people. Having had those who know to carry this message. We have a responsibility and an opportunity. And I know, as I look back over my life, I think the greatest growth, and it's one of the greatest growths in my life has been through the 12th step. And that's very shocking. But it talks about, you know, we don't have to go out and sober up, folks, and I think all of us get off into this thing. And I did too. I didn't understand what the 12th step was. I thought the guy got sober and said, if he didn't get sober, it was my fault. If he got drunk, it was my fault. And I wondered what I was doing wrong. And the book said, all I got to do is carry a message. It didn't say I had to sober up nobody. And I think some of us get out of whack. We carry a healing message, but I think some of us think we're supposed to heal drunks. Now, how is one drunk that was powerless going to heal another drunk? You really can't carry a simple message. And all I got to tell another drunk is about the grace of God. All I got to tell another drunk is what I was like and what happened, how it is now. You know, what the power of this program lies within God and lies within the 12 steps in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. All I am is a simple messenger. I think the greatest example I ought to ever make a talk, one of the greatest examples I ever heard of a messenger was Paul Revere. Paul was one of the finest messengers, did the best job. If Paul hadn't did his job that night, we'd all be British citizens. He did a hell of a job that night. Now, Paul was not an intellectual. They had some smart guys around. Paul wasn't one of them smart guys. He was a silversmith that worked with his hand. He was a craftsman. He wasn't one of the intellectual types. Ben Franklin and them guys, they were intellectuals. And if they had sent Ben Franklin, he'd stopped on the first corner to give a speech. He never would have got the job done. They told Paul Revere to carry the message, the British are coming. And he rode through the night everywhere. He said, the British are coming, the British are coming. The message is what was effective, because the people took action on the message. Paul Revere never did get down off his horse to give out advice. You know what I mean? He never did. He just carried the message. And that's what my book tells me. He said, carry the message. Carry this message from one alcoholic to the other. He says, if you find one that is not interested, leave him and go on. I'm sure somebody else will be interested. Our responsibility lies there. You know, the recovery of this program lies within God, not within the messenger. So I think this has been a fantastic thing in my life, and surely, you know, many, many things have happened. I won't go on over and over about how it is for me, but I've had many, many things happen to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I share these things sometimes, not just in passing, but maybe for the benefit, everything to benefit for someone to you, what it's like now. Because maybe he'll leave here wondering. Maybe he won't know about what these miracles are in my life. But as I said, you know, when I first came to AA, you know, how I had problems even getting into the treatment center, being around the old dormitory, being around Alcoholics Anonymous. But I stayed there, and I started working with people. I started helping the guys that was there. And people began to realize, see what I was all about. They began to see that I had a desire to stop drinking it. And then everybody from Alcoholics Anonymous became, you know, I had more help than anybody. And then after 5 years of sobriety, the same place that I couldn't stay, I was serving on the board of directors of the place. Same place couldn't stay here. I was serving on the board, the director. That's a heck of a thing. And then, you know, after some years, I became involved and opened up the Serenity House, which is a treatment center for alcoholics. And, you know, I've had many things happen in my life. I guess, you know, I began to involve in my state and in my community and working with alcoholics. And today, you know, I serve on many boards and commissions and I've been appointed by the last four governors of the state of Arkansas to direct the programs that work with the alcoholic. And it's, you know, it's very, very peculiar that, you know, a guy that couldn't even go in one of those places now sits on the board of six people that controls every program in the state. But I think this is the wonders of God, and God's grace is sufficient. And I think, you know, this is what it is to be here today. And every time that I can return, you say thank you. Every time that I can come before Alcoholics Anonymous, say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, thank you really. As we say, you know, we have to have the attitude of gratitude, and I think it's more than an attitude. I think the gratitude has to become an action in our life. We have to show our gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think each time we return, that God begins to grow in our life. And I think it's so much like you. One of my favorite stories. You know that of the 10 leopards, as they came to the master, these 10 leopards were, they were sick and they wanted some help. And I really see how he was able to work with people of all kinds. And he did not break the customs of whatever was going on in those days. And they didn't let the leopards come amongst the ordinary folks. They kind of kept them off to the side, like they did the alcoholics in 19, still in our time. You know, they kind of put them off to the side. And as these leopards come, they asked to be healed. And he said, well, y'all stay, don't come. And the priest said, y'all go on toward the temple. And as you get, you know, you'll be all right. And as they walked toward the temple, they were healed. And one came back. You know, it's really about like Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess. You know, about 1 out of 10 comes back. And I wonder, you know, sometimes what happened to those other 9 leopards. You know, the ones that got over one, they got over their leprosy. And they were cleansed in the flesh. But I wonder what other problems they had in their lives. You know, I wonder how much growth they had to wrestle with life from then on. They got over the worst problem, or one of them. But I'm sure they run up to things they couldn't handle. And I often wonder what happened to those other people's lives. I know one of them probably said, well, boy, now that I'm over this, I got to go see what my girlfriend's doing. One of them probably said, I got to get down to the camel lot to get me a new camel. You know, he really had to have a ride. All of them had other interests once they got well. But one came back. One. And he came back and said, thank you. And the master looked at him and he said, you know, the rest of them are over the leprosy. But he told this last one, he said, thy faith shall make you whole. And this is what we can do as we come back. So one day, maybe, we can become whole. Thank you. God bless you.